here as well. Kimbrew, I give it to you. Tell us about all this.
I'm just moderating the panel, and I put together some clips from a documentary that I'm working on about the history of digital music sampling. A couple of the people on the panel are on this. I might as well introduce them while they're right before they're about to speak. So rather than having a long series of introductions, I'm going to save it. And I thought I'd just start off by showing the first batch of clips that'll raise an initial set of questions that I'll have for Larry Farrar, who is a distinguished composer and the head. Would you please lean into your mic, because I don't have my script with me. Give us your academic title, please.
I'm a professor and chair of the Department of Music and Performing Arts here at NYU.
That's the sort of thing that you inevitably screw up as a moderator. Thank you. So I'm going to start the set of clips, and each one will be about a minute long. And each panelist will initially talk for 7 or 8 minutes. I wanted to make sure that we carved out enough time so that we can have a lot of Q&A from the audience also, as well as discussion, loose discussion amongst the panelists. So without further ado, here we go.
Pop, baby!
This is a journey.
We never anticipated, like, getting someone to pay for James Brown going, and that's it.
We kind of looked at music as an assemblage of sounds, and we felt that you couldn't copyright a sound.
Sampling was a very intricate thing for us. It was a collage. We was creating a collage.
It's actually taking sounds and meshing them together and putting them all in time to come up with something totally different.
Music sampling is where someone takes a piece of something that someone else created and samples it. So they intersperse it in something else.
If you sample one note of a sound recording, it's copyright infringement.
Say someone recorded this sound. So does that mean they own it if I go?
Basically, when I'm sampling, I have all these artists. They're in my band.
You know, it's like Legos, you know what I mean? If someone says, here's a bunch of Legos put in together, and you have something to work with, where if someone says, okay, here's a bunch of plastic, mold it, and then start building it, you know, kids like the building. And you.
So, the reason why I showed this set of clips is because I can't assume that everyone in the room just automatically knows, well, what sampling is when the word is evoked. So sort of set the terms for it. But there's one particular thing that someone said that I hoped would start the conversation, and I'm directing the first question to Larry, which is Anthony Berman, the entertainment lawyer, says, if you sample one note of a sound recording, it's copyright infringement. And there's an important case that was decided last year?
Actually, initially in 2002, and then it went to the appellate. And
why don't you tell us about, you know, how you ended up hanging out with Puffy last week?
Okay. Well, the Bridgeport claim to which you're referring is in Tennessee, and in that circuit, I guess now you can say that if you sample, that is, you digitally re-record one note or one sound, it doesn't have to be a note, it could be literally a woodblock, which isn't a note by definition, it has no pitch. And so you can literally just sample that, and you are infringing it. And when the DJ said, but what if I do this to it, and then he changed the sound completely, essentially that was what was at issue in Bridgeport v. Dimension Film, and that is that it was actually three notes, repeating three notes of a George Clinton riff. The key is, though, that It was changed, it was manipulated so radically that no one could possibly, even a trained musician, could possibly, in hearing it in the manipulated form, recognize it as a George Clinton riff, a guitar riff in this case. And so, correctly, at least in terms of common sense, the district judge granted a motion for summary judgment to the defendant, said, yeah, this is crazy. This would be certainly a fair use. And it was appealed, and at the appellate level, that decision was overturned, and essentially what Mr. Berman said was a decision of the court. If you sample one note or one sound, you're infringing. And that brings a completely different level of a threshold, let's say, a new threshold to what one would expect to be fair use. Certainly it's a much higher threshold in the underlying composition rights. And understand that there are essentially two broad areas of rights. There is the right of the master recording, and that's what we're talking about right now, sampling. And there's also the right of the underlying composition. Now, the underlying of a composition of a da is in on anybody's radar screen not protectable, so you don't have to pay anything on that. The question then becomes, you know, what is the bright line? Where is the blue line? And unfortunately, there isn't any. It's very much context bound. One of the things that interests me a great deal in fair use is because I do a great deal of consulting for all the major record companies and many of them the independent companies and the publishers and the motion picture companies. And I look at this from both ends because I work both with plaintiffs and defendants, but I'm concerned at the explosion of frivolous suits. And so it's not just the direction that we've heard for the most part since last night, and that is the problem of the small person, the person who doesn't have a lot of equity or power, being crushed by major corporations. In fact, in many cases, it is a frivolous lawsuit that one after the other, that not only is causing a great deal of harm to the overall creative process, but also to the corporations and to the artists. And I think it was Charles Sims who mentioned that there are authors, there are composers and lyricists who are also collecting percentages of those royalties from those record companies, independent or major. And what often happens is, even if an injunction motion is not immediately granted, what happens almost immediately is, insofar as the writers have essentially indemnified the major companies or the independent companies from any exposure to such suits, they basically stop the flow of royalties to those artists. And artists then suddenly, writers, composers, performers, suddenly are making no money. And I want to just give you a couple of examples of some of the kinds of cases that are highly frivolous. In 2005, I was involved probably in about five issues, literally from federal court in Washington State to the Southern District of Florida in Miami to Boston, the First Circuit, I should say, and here, the Second Circuit, the Southern District of New York. And in each of these instances, four or five, the defendants who I was working with won motions for summary judgment. But in so winning, they probably spent $250,000 or more to show that a particular claim was frivolous. Let me give you a few examples. One, for example, in fact, I'll just wrap two together and just describe one. One was for the rapper Fabulous, not Fabulous, but Fabulous. And it was a hit song of his called Youngin', and in parenthesis, Holla Back. Now, another artist wrote a song, Holla Back, and there was really no concrete evidence of access, that is, that Fabulous had ever heard the plaintiff's work, yet there was a suggestion that there was. But even if there was, and even if, in fact, in this case, Fabulous copied what was purported to have been copied, it would have been a legal copying, because the only similarity, and this is also the case in a Memphis Bleek case that was in the Southern District of Florida, where we also won this motion, a motion for summary judgment, all that was similar was Hollaback. That's it. Hollaback repeated in the chorus section, and the fact that it was in that rhythm, Hollaback, da-da-da, da-da-da, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. One of the most common rhythm motives in all of music. In fact, it's one of Bach's favorite motives. And so what we basically said to the court is, this is frivolous, and the court accepted it, but at least $250,000 later. Just yesterday, before coming here last night, I was in a federal court, and I won't say what particular instance this was, because the judge in this case asked for a hearing. He asked for the musicologist to come forward on both sides because we have pending a motion for summary judgment, and he wanted to get more of an understanding, perhaps more of a visceral understanding of what was going on. Now, the undisputed facts in this instance are that what is at issue is the setting of a very common, I mean a really common phrase, just a stock phrase, for which we found 60, 70 other songs that had the same title, for which we had literally countless uses out in literature, newspapers, and so on. So it's a stock phrase. And it was set not to an identical melody. Melodies constituted of both pitch and rhythm, but just the pitch was the same, and only part of the pitches. So there are eight pitches in the plaintiff song, and the only thing that's similar is da-dee-da-dee-da-dee-da. Those are on the scale degrees 3-5. You know, like do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti? That's scale degrees 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So scale degrees, just two scale degrees, 3-5, 3-5, 3-5. Six of those are common. The last note in plaintiff's song is different. The first two notes in defendant's song are different. So that's all. These are undisputed. That is, there are no harmonic, no structural, no rhythmic similarities. This is it. And so in court yesterday, I said, well, think of the song. It's fun to stay at the YMCA. It's the same, and it's at the beginning of the chorus. Or, someday I wish upon a star. I actually have some lyrics, because I can't remember the lyrics. Let me just see if I've got it. Oh, yes. Nothing could be finer than to be in Carolina. At that point, the judge started laughing. Now, this oscillation of 3-5, 3-5, 3-5 is so generic as to make someone wonder what could possibly be in the mind of plaintiffs here. But plaintiffs, recognizing full well that that large companies and independent companies, rather than spend $250,000 or more just to move to a summary judgment or to have to try it at least $750,000 or more, that it's easier to write a check for $15,000 or $25,000. And then the company or the artist becomes a mark. And then you're right back to where you started. And so it's not all that the big companies and the big artists are essentially in control and have all the power, but in fact they are also targets. And in fact, the artist, who a very, very well-known artist and composer in this particular issue, said that in deposition, that essentially, you know, well, why are they coming after you? Well, because I'm a target, because I, you know, obviously have the deep pockets. So that's also part of the story. Now, we're talking about Bridgeport, and just to bring this finally to full circle, it wasn't a week ago, but it was about a month ago in March on our spring vacation, so I wasn't missing school. We have Pierre Hohenberg here, who is our vice provost. I didn't miss any school, Pierre. But during our spring break, I was indeed down in Nashville in that same circuit. And this was not a, it was a sampling issue and is also a publishing issue. It was one of the Bridgeport claims. There are over 400 claims that Bridgeport made, and all of the major record companies were involved, and I've probably been involved in 60 or 70 of them with various companies. In this particular claim, Puffy, yes. Sean Combs was named as a co-defendant with his Bad Boy Records, with Universal Music Publishing Group for the publishing, and with Warner Records on the master side. So these were all co-defendants. The song was Ready to Die off the Ready to Die album of Notorious B.I.G. Interestingly, Notorious B.I.G.'s estate was not named a co-defendant. And what was at issue was an Ohio Players 1971 sample. It was from a song, Singin' in the Morning, which was not a hit by any means, off of an album of theirs, Pain, which was an early album and not a major hit as well. And so this was not a big song that you would necessarily identify with the Ohio Players. They had bigger hits later in the mid-70s. And what they essentially took was a 5.5-second sample that was, for the most part, a horn riff. It was some guitar that you could barely hear. And at the end of the riff, you hear one of the singers in Ohio Players sing, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, sing. And that was it. After each ready, I'm ready, I'm ready, I'm ready to die statement in the chorus section of Biggie's Ready to Die song, you hear this blaring out of the Ohio Players. You actually hear that 25% of the time. Now, while you're hearing that for that 25% of the time, there are numerous other things going on. In fact, I created a score for the court, and there were 15 different parts, of which there were just three parts that were actually sampled. So essentially, about 20% of 25% of the song was at issue, just in a purely quantitative sense. Now, the judgment was, if you read about it, that the plaintiffs were awarded 100% of the publishing, 100% of the master rights, and a $4.2 million punitive damages award, as well as compensatory damages.
And also, didn't they essentially have to pull the record off the shelves?
And their injunction, of course, was given. This is being appealed, and it seems to many to be rather excessive. So the point is that there are really not necessarily two sides to the story, but there are at least two paradigms that we want to keep in mind. And believe me when I say that I often work for the person who is out there and who makes a claim against one of the major companies. And if I believe in it, I certainly stand behind it. My sense here is that fair use is of particular importance because I see an explosion, particularly of frivolous suits, and I think that fair use could help to mitigate that explosion.
Thank you. We're going to continue our conversation, so I don't even want to think about this as individual presentations. After I ask the question of, a big question of each person, then, like I said, we're going to open it up so that we can discuss as a panel, but I also want to make sure we have time for Q&A from the audience. So the next section is, I'll be asking Claudia Gonson, who is the manager of Magnetic Fields, and that's how she primarily identifies herself, although I think she has a beautiful singing voice, and she plays piano in the group, so sorry for bringing that up.
That's clearly why I'm here, right?
No. The next set of clips begin to raise the question of, the people who created the original things that were sampled, and that's something that, in order to have an interesting conversation about sampling, we can't forget that huge part of the story. So here's another minute.
Now, I'm empathetic to the other argument, which is that you don't want your music stolen or wasn't what you intended it to be. I care about my music just as much as anyone else.
The importance for us in getting paid for these things is that this is our livelihood.
You pay for a guitar, you pay for a piano, you pay for anything else that you make a song with. I think you definitely have to pay for it.
I mean, you can't just have a record that's made up of everybody else's records and then not pay them for it and do it without their permission.
Yeah, I got sued for sampling my own stuff.
So many groups and sample my stuff. They say I'm the world samplers, number one samplers drummer, so hey, I haven't got a penny for it yet though, but.
I don't care about your past.
I've
prefer to get my name on the record saying this is Clyde playing. Instead of, the money is not the important thing.
Well,
so, sorry for freezing on Greg. Greg, that's Greg Tate, a great music historian. Okay, Claudia, I know you said earlier that, well, you don't know of any hip-hop acts who have sampled Magnetic Fields music, but nevertheless, well, actually, this connects to the previous panel, which is, I know that an increasingly large part of, well, the money that you all make as artists, as, you know, and as a manager, comes from sync licenses. And so could you just talk a little bit about that, and also just, well, the importance of, well, I mean, being paid for the creative work that, you know, Stephen Merritt and you all do.
Well, actually, I thought I'd tell a funny story. Just because it's always good to tell a funny story. About 10 years ago, a former 80s pop singer, who was the 90s, decided to cover a song of Stephen's, and I manage him, so I'm always involved in all this stuff, the copyright and the clearances, and it's pretty much what I do all day long. And England, I don't know, I'd be curious to know about everybody else's thoughts about this, but, you know, Europe just, they just, it's different. It's really different there. They just don't care. So we got contacted by a really famous DJ in England who said, you know, we're going to cover your song. This girl, she's going to do a great version of it. And the song's called Hopeless. And the words were, you know, there's no use even trying because it's hopeless. All of our dreams are dying of overdoses. All of our plans are lying in 10-car road wrecks. Anyway, the point was, it's a very down song, very hopeless song. She came back 6 months later, fully recorded, ready to release, and she had hired a group of pert young girls to sing, you know, you can make it, it's okay, you know, and she had rewritten the words so that it was really hopeful, and so, you know, she kept the chorus, you know, there's no use even trying because it's hopeless, but then the verses were, you know, keep in, you know, keep with it, you're gonna be fine, it's good, it's gonna be okay, and all the girls were going, you know, what did it say, don't give up, you know, and all that. So, we did, in fact, ask our lawyer to call their lawyer. And we said, you know, okay, use it. Do please write on the liner notes that you rewrote, or, you know, just write that you, it was a composition by Stephen Merritt and this 80s, former 80s pop singer. But we don't want you to take any of the publishing rights for it because you never asked permission in advance. And they were really mad. And the reason they were really mad was because we're nobody and they were famous. And I think the more I listened to, especially in the prior one, I mean, this issue of bullying, I really, really agree with all of this. It's like if Warner Chappell has control of something, they're going to hit you for the $10,000 for the 6-second clip. And if it's me, I'm probably going to give it to you for free. I'm not really sure how, I mean, I think that in some way, we had talked a little bit beforehand about the idea of regulating these issues. I don't know enough about the legal situation to actually understand whether that would be possible. But anyway, I just thought I'd tell that story because it was sort of an amusing story about copyright issues. And as from an artistic level, I guess you really do want to feel that you're not getting your intentions. So it's not like they're making a collage out of it or a sample out of it the way that sampling works. It was more like they were actually taking the composition and really trying to re-represent it with different content, different meaning. I guess the things that are really interesting in my mind, I don't have a huge ethical issue with issues of our music being taken and used for free in certain ways. I really don't. I don't have ethical issues really with people freely taking our music from the internet or through digital downloading sites. I do feel like it's all about money in the end of the day, and I'm very just curious about the future of us as musicians and music managers and people in the music industry who are not, you know, major label people, just in terms of making money. And the stuff that interests me is, it seems to me like there's an interesting, like, ethical thing going on that I don't I don't personally have a problem with Magnetic Fields' music appearing in a Honda commercial if that's how I'm going to make money, if I can't sell records anymore because people would like to download that music for free. I'm sorry, I'm not really talking about sampling right now because I don't really have a huge knowledge of that, but I do have other ways that I engage with the world of freeness of music. And I feel like I sometimes get caught coming and going on this one because people say, well, you know, that's disgusting that you would sell your song to that ad. And I actually really don't have a problem with that anymore because I kind of feel like I don't really care how we make money. I mean, if the Magnetic Fields are start our own little, you know, free download and all of our records are free and you can have them, that's fine. But I'd really like to know how we're going to make money. So I tend to, in fact, spend a lot of my life doing sync licenses for films and ads and television as a way to make money. In music, my understanding is right now that there are for bands, I mean, there's lots of different ways of presenting music, but for bands that your income from royalties is really very little of your stream of income nowadays, and that the way that bands are making more money is through live performances, through merchandising, packaging. Like if you want to make a record with a hologram on the front, you're probably going to make a little more money selling records, and also through sync licenses. Sync licenses are when you put your song into an ad or film. It's viable, and I'm happy with it, and it's what I'm doing. I mean, I really, about 3 or 4 years ago, realized that that was what I had to start learning how to do, and I called lots of people in LA, and I was like, what do I need to do to learn how to do this? So I deal with lots of little tiny contracts all the time. I don't know how to fight the hard fight. Like, in the last panel, they were talking a lot about Warner Chappell asking for $10,000 for 6 seconds of music. If somebody comes to me and says, here's my budget, it's $15,000, you know, we have $1,000 for our music clearances, you know, I'm going to either give it to them for free or limited free use. That's totally, I just look at everything sort of individually. But I am kind of interested in just listening to everything about how we're both, as music, as artists and as me as a manager, it's like, I am hit on both sides of this one. Like right now we're developing an album with a cover that uses some photos from the middle part of this century, and we don't know who shot them because they were shot in the middle of World War II, and they're in a French book, and the book was published in the 60s, and who knows where that book company is going to be. And so, you know, do we clear the book cover? I mean, I feel like a lot of the time there is these issues of, like, you know, in the end of the day, I just think it's just about us analyzing these things on a case-by-case basis. But I don't really have, I guess I don't, it, just to answer your question, I don't think I have a hugely ethical issue of, like, the issue of people taking stuff of ours for free, as long as I can kind of understand how to make a viable living as a music manager and as a musician. I'm trying to think if there's any other rule.
No, we can, why don't we return to this discussion, and I'd like to, we can move on to kind of talk about how things have changed in sampling. Hank Shockley, the next panelist, is a producer for Public Enemy, along with his brother Keith Shockley, Chuck D, Eric Sadler, and am I missing anyone? I could have added more, but they made records in the late 1980s. Took advantage of this emerging technology, digital sampling technology, at a time when hip hop, you know, just did not have the commercial stature that it has today. And so they were largely allowed to kind of operate under the radar, but make what are recognized as, I'm talking about the albums, It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back and Fear of a Black Planet. Those two records in particular are recognized as not just hip-hop classics, but classics of music. In fact, Fear of a Black Planet was admitted into the Library of Congress's sound recording registry of, you know, each year they put in 50 sound recordings of historical importance, like Neil Armstrong landing on the moon or Dizzy Gillespie. It crosses not just music, but into news and other historical events. So this is, you know, just to put this into context, these are hugely important albums that essentially couldn't be made today. And I'll show another minute of clips that sort of sets that up, and then I'll ask you a question, Hank.
I think that once people who held music copyrights got wise to how much money hip-hop was making, then it became kind of a feasting frenzy.
But then slowly people got more serious about copyright and copyright law, and more lawyers got involved.
And what that did is it obviated an entire genre of music or an entire style of hip-hop.
Records like It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, 3 Feet High and Rising, they're kind of like artifacts of an earlier time.
Those records were just full of samples.
There was definitely a time when sampling artists could get away with murder, and we did.
Groups like Public Enemy could no longer make their powerful sounds in the way they wished to.
They had to switch up their composition strategy, mainly because of the impact that their records had had on the music industry itself.
Because over our shoulders, we had lawyers, A&R people from the record company that's supposed to be protecting the record company.
You could be completely blindsided by some gigantic, outrageous, price.
I might have to pay, like some people did Eric Sermon, I believe, over $100,000 to sample one song.
At least I didn't get you with your mouth open. Well, sort of. Sorry. Hank, I guess I have a couple questions, but would you start out telling us how those records were made, and were you worried about getting sued for sampling those records? And when I say how are those records made, talk about, for instance, how you put together Don't Believe the Hype, or you can choose another example, and well, I might have a follow-up question.
Well, first of all, you have to understand something. Back in 1983, the only provisions that we had against any kind of copyright infringements was actually re-recording someone's piece. You had to take 8 bars of it. And if you took 8 bars and looped it, a la Sugar Hill Gang when they first started, they took Good Times and they looped it for 8 bars. And that record was up for, injunctions and all kinds of different things. So the only way that the only kind of legal stuff that we had at that time was taking someone's music for 8 bars and re-recording it. The other thing that also existed at the time was you couldn't take a whole song and record that particular song and put it out. Because if you understand, a lot of breakbeat records that we get a lot of our breaks from, what these guys do is they go find these old 45s and they record the entire 45 onto an LP, and they put a collection of those songs together and they resell that record in the marketplace to DJs so that they can rebuy these albums. Now, that was an infringement because you're taking the entire recording and you're recording this record and you're re-releasing this record as the recording itself. So I understand all of that. And so when I went into the studios, well, the first thing I wanted to do was say, well, okay, well, I'm not going to take 8 bars of it, and I'm not going to record an entire track of a record. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take what I consider to be like a little snippet. I would take like a little horn hit, or I would take even a hi-hat. I would take, there was nothing inside the record. We would take like a tambourine and then loop the tambourine going so that we can create just the sound that we want of a tambourine that came from a Motown record. Well, it's a tambourine. I'm looking for a bass sound, just a little boom. We would take that little boom and then work with those frequencies and create a bass line off of that. So there was things that we've done as far as sampling, as far as sampling goes, that was kind of like, what I consider to be underneath the radar. So thus, the record companies and everybody in the industry had no way of understanding what it is that we were doing and what it was that how we made the sounds. And most of the artists that we've sampled from listened to our records and had no idea that we was even using anything from their records until all of a sudden, for some strange reason, everybody has gotten, a little bit smart in this game. And then all of a sudden, you started getting, calls from, cats that have heard their vocal from on a record, and then they would say, well, okay, we want you to pay us for, you know, for the sampling. You know, I'm not here to determine whether or not sampling is legal or illegal. My question is that, and I understand from a musician standpoint, I think that everybody should get paid for. You should, if you sample, like the guy said in the thing, you sample one note, you should get paid for it. My question is determining the threshold for that allows that to go on. For example, after the people started getting, you know, we started getting hit with sample claims. They wasn't soups at the time, they were just sample claims. And what we would do is we would go in now and forge a deal with the particular publishing company, artist, whatever the case may be, whoever is the holder of that copyright. Now, keep in mind that that's a jungle in itself because, you know, first of all, you have to figure out, well, who actually owns the publishing? Because I made a deal with George Clinton that you saw on there, and he says, yeah, man, you can sample my song, and then I get hit with a lawsuit from Bridgeport Music.
Which, all right. By the way, George Clinton lost the copyrights to a significant chunk of his recorded work, which is how he ended up getting sued for sampling his own work and how Hank got sued.
So that brings one issue. Like, how do you know who actually owns the copyrights and of the song so that you can make these clearances? And then the other thing that I find that to be so, you know, so amazing is after you've made these, you know, these particular claims, you've cleared your sample, so to speak, and now all of a sudden you want to take that sample and some. Now I'm this is what I'm faced with today, is, you know, for example, Jarhead calls me up, the film Jarhead. They say, well, look, we want to use Fight the Power within Jarhead in the movie, and I say, yeah, okay, well then you can do that, and they want to pay a significant fee for that. Well, then what the other claim comes back to us, like, okay, now we have to now go back and re-clear the samples that we've already paid for. So that's another area, is how long is these things cleared for, and what is the, and how the usages of it. So when you start to understand, this whole sea gets very, 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 very murky. So it gets very, very difficult to one, find out who owns the sample, how do you clear it, and how effectively long can you clear it for? For example, you know, with the Dr. Dre case, you know, where they sampled a little piece from a Funkadelic record that ended up in a movie that he sampled it in 1987. It ends up into a movie in 1993, and these guys get sued for it. From a movie that incorporated the record in 1993, you know, so there's a timeline on that. And then the other obvious issue to me comes from is how much, you know, Henry,
Larry.
I'm sorry, my name is Henry, but I thought your name was Larry. I'll get it right. Larry said that, you know, after you've taken these samples and you rehooked it up, you switched it, you can change the frequencies, you can change the pitch of the samples, you can filter the samples, you can do so much with samplings in the digital domain now where it's very virtually unrecognizable. All right? Virtually unrecognizable. But if you decide that you're gonna clear it anyway. Now the other question, you know, comes into, well, if I how long do how much should I pay for, you know, come on, how long should I pay for, you know, zigga zigga zigga, how much do you pay for this? Is there some sort of a menu system that we can set up? So my question goes from, you know, not just necessarily understanding that there should be some sort of free use. Well, I understand that everything shouldn't be free, because I understand that everybody has to make a living at this. But my question goes into, what kind of parameters can we set up that's going to allow us to be able to take advantage of the samples in the truest form that it takes place, and not just declare whatever we want to declare at the moment because we just want to get as much money as we could possibly get.
And actually, you raised a lot of questions, but I'll save them for later.
That's okay.
Well, I'm going to just shut up and play the rest of it.
Just at the time, the technology is enabling anybody to be a creator. So just when it matters most, the law steps in and destroys the opportunity that otherwise would exist for people to create and express themselves.
So we're operating with a lot of antiquated assumptions about what musical creativity is.
I don't think copyright necessarily fails with regard to music. I think the system works fine. It's just it creates a lot of tension because people want to use stuff and not pay for it.
To take all of the remnants of the past and make something new out of that is perhaps the intrinsic power of our generation.
I think about the way Walt Disney was created, right? All of Disney's greatest works were taking other people's works and doing something different with them.
That's how society moves forward. It doesn't just invent new things, it evolves through taking old things and changing them.
The copyright law needs to mold a little bit. We don't know where. I mean, it's not working in several ways. There is some creativity that's being inhibited. There's no doubt about that.
We're going to switch out laptops now so that Paul can Paul Miller. It will be the next person speaking, A.K.A. DJ Spooky, that subliminal kid. Paul straddles a number of different worlds, from the world of, well, the clubs to the art museums to, well, scholarship. He has a book that came out last year on MIT Press called Rhythm Science. I'll let him to talk about it. You can switch them out. And I guess while we're switching it out, maybe I'll use the time really quickly to ask a couple follow-up questions of the panel. Hank raised one issue in which you were talking about, yeah, how you can sample, scramble, refilter, mess with the sound, in other words. And I was on another panel, I think it was at Harvard Conference last year with Larry, and you raised a really interesting point about, well, discovery. And would you talk about how, Pro Tools programs and like the hit, do you know what I'm talking
yes,
about?
Yes, okay, yeah, okay. Well, yeah, that was the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School. One of the things that came up was the issue of, well, how do you really figure out whether or not something has, after being manipulated, actually come from your original recording? And one of the things that is often required or requested or subpoenaed during discovery are the Pro Tools. That is the actual Pro Tools that you, literally track by track have created your song from. There could be five different tracks, six different tracks just for the percussion. There could be three or four tracks for the guitars and several tracks for vocals. And when you get those original Pro Tools...
Sorry about that. Pro Tools, I didn't set up the question well, is a software program much like for audio editing, much like Final Cut Pro for video. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I should have probably said something then. And so the bottom line is that it's very easy for musicologists on the other side of the claim to excavate essentially where you got your original sound from. So there's really no way to hide.
I guess this is where I'd love to jump in, is the fact that actually with so much of the contemporary software going on, whether it's Sonar, Maxim SP, there's so many different softwares that let you kind of edit and take away, you know, from the original composition, that you're looking at the idea of the composer here is no longer looking at the actual notes. The loops are our notes. When you take the kind of material and make the repetition, that's the palette. So we're not looking at 16th note, 8th note, A flat, G sharp, stuff like that. Whenever I'm making tracks, and I make tracks using records all the time, I've never been sued in my life. I edit tracks down to the last snare drum or whatever. And the idea is that you have to, I think, dig a little deeper into the process. One thing I find fascinating with Hank's style is that back in that time period, you have to remember, a sampler, like a Akai S3000, it was a big deal if it had 32 megabytes of memory. For me, let's see, I have my keychain here. This is a gigabyte, you know, it's like, And the samplers used to be about, you know, the size of maybe this desk here. And so to be able to manipulate the digital information in a 32 megabyte file back then would actually take a sheer volume of space. And if you go further back in time to, say, for example, the earliest computers that were used to make music, say, for example, the RCA Mark II Victor after World War II, which is up at Columbia University, that's a computer the size of this whole room that could just make a couple bleeps. So as we look at technology's progress and it's, you know, the way it absorbs many of the issues of miniaturization and dispersion of almost all aspects of how we would think of creativity, you can edit, you can transform, all of that stuff becomes part of your compositional palette in a way that probably previous generations wouldn't even be able to understand, let alone engage legally. So what I want to do is jump into my talk by just walking you guys through a little bit of history here. Behind me, this is the cover of Scientific American in 1914 by one of my favorite photographers, Eddie and Jules Murray. And what you're seeing here is he invented what they call, well, not invented, but helped elaborate a style of photography called stop motion photography, where you were essentially being able to break apart a movement of, you know, whether it was a horse riding or birds flying or whatever, in a way that previous generations would never have been able to understand because they didn't have the technology to be able to see like that. So the stop motion photography initiated a huge revolution in scientific photography, much in the same way that recordings initiated a revolution in being able to actually capture sound. So if we jump forward here, human beings at this point, we generate about what we call 5 petabytes of information a year, which is basically more information than our species has created in its entire existence on this planet. Most of the information is based on cell phone frequencies, faxes, telephone messages, and so on. So if you think about a gigabyte versus a petabyte or a terabyte or a gigabyte and megabyte, kilobyte, hectobyte, et cetera, the idea here is that you're looking at information itself as becoming a kind of an ecology. We're moving further and further into this idea of massive, huge volume of information. How do you filter it? How do you transform it? How do you make information reflect culture? So what I look at when I'm hearing Hank Shockley talk and when I'm hearing Larry and when I'm hearing the folks from all these different perspectives, what we have to understand is that the 21st century is being faced with a series of questions about what exactly is creativity. I start out mainly as a writer and artist, and I considered sampling to be a form of sculpture. This is a very famous piece by Robert Rauschenberg from 1955, and he created a series of pieces called combines. So by collaging and pulling fragments from the detritus of the landscape around him, he created what they call fine art. For me and Hank Shockley, we pull from our record collections, we pull from our archives, we pull from the radio waves, telephone conversations, files online, you name it. But the idea is that one generation would view it as fine art, another one would receive a lawsuit. So what I'm trying to figure out right now is most of the issues that I look at as a creative artist operating in a field, you know, on a global level, is the sense that we're having a conflict between different time periods and how you interpret the law and the way it sort of controls the creative act. So Robert Rauschenberg, of course, and Andy Warhol, or even other people like Jeff Koons, have usually had a series of lawsuits that have tried to at least pave the way somehow for the fine arts, whereas the music scene, it's extremely uncertain as to who owns many of the rights he's talking about. In my book, for example, Rhythm Science, just came out a little while ago, it's on MIT, it's kind of a manifesto, it's not necessarily a straight-up academic book, but I collect records by artists and authors as a small section of my record collection. So when I was compiling the CD that went with the book, I got really rare recordings of, say, for example, James Joyce reading Finnegan's Wake into a phonograph that Thomas Edison had given him. I got really rare recording of Gertrude Stein reading a poem about Picasso, Tristan Tzara's Dada manifestos, and so on. And I mix those with, you know, Gertrude Stein sort of rhyming over hip-hop beat or Anton Artaud's radio theater works. But with the idea of collapsing the distinction between these sort of high modernist authors that are heroes of the academy and mixing them more with an urban kind of aesthetic. So my next couple projects after that, I ended up going through my next mix CD after my book is a collection of Trojan Records, which is a very legendary Jamaican label. It's founded by Arthur Duke Reed. He's a legendary figure in Jamaica. And the idea here is that the sound system culture in Jamaica actually collapsed most Western concepts of copyright law because essentially people were just making copies of records, playing them on their sound system out in the parks way before hip-hop. And the idea was that you'd have a sound system outside. He had a truck that was literally called a Trojan truck, and they'd set up these sound system speakers and just start playing records. So the idea was that once a rhythm became popular, everybody would hear it, and they'd run back to their studio and make a copy of that rhythm. And next thing you know, people put out whole albums of the same rhythm. And that became incredibly popular. And Jamaican culture was always listening to what was going on American radio. And of course, if you look at DJ Kool Herc in terms of hip-hop, he was Jamaican, and he came back up to the U.S. with this kind of sound system aesthetic. And the rest is history, as they say. So Arthur Duke Reed would actually create these kinds of dub plates. And those were meant to be specialized versions of popular songs. Nobody was quite sure who owned those rhythms. Nobody was quite sure who owned those records. But the idea, people would actually have what they call sound system battles to see which was the most popular rhythm. And that would eventually become the way that, you know, determined what was the hit of the day. So turntable culture, DJ culture, the fine arts, you have to think of these as aesthetics that are inherited from the idea both of collage and of being able to manipulate music, not just as music, but music as information. Thomas Edison, kind of course, is one of the founding figures of this kind of scene. But my motto for this is, there's a very famous poet phrase where it just essentially you say, architecture is nothing but frozen music. What I want to do is dethaw that process, reverse engineer it, and look at music as nothing but liquid architecture. Thinking about the idea of flow and the ebb and flow between people as a kind of a system of exchange. Did everybody get a CD?
Yeah.
Okay. On those CDs, each of them are slightly different. The idea here is what I like to invoke is Lewis Hyde's idea of the gift economy. So if you open those CDs up, you'll notice that they're all hand-stamped. And if you got the one with the Vanishing Cheshire Cat, that's a lot of my remixes of people like Missy Elliott and Sean Paul. If you got the one that's black, that's a project I just did with the Luxembourg Philharmonic Orchestra. It's a 76-piece orchestra meant for sampling. If you got the one with the Parachutes, that's my mix CD that with Trojan Records. It's about 30 years of Jamaican music. If you got the one with the Dancing Clown, that's my remixes of the Beastie Boys or the Doors and some other bands. And if you got the one with the Dancing Indian Woman, I work with quite a few Indian artists like Nitin Sahni or Talvin Singh. And so on. So that's kind of the hip-hop scene in Bombay or New Delhi. But the idea of giving out those CDs and invoking the idea of the gift economy is not only to get everybody to think about the fact that this is an exchange, but to get everybody to hopefully trade, you know, and get them into this idea of both file sharing and the idea of the network as a kind of social process that music is a reflection of. No one is an island to themselves, and I'm kind of trying to think about DJing as not only a social network, but a collaborative filter where people exchange and freely kind of engage these transformative social sculptures as a way of making music better. And again, that's going back to the Jamaican model rather than the American model. One of my favorite models recently is made by a graduate student named Reginald Smith of MIT. Where he went through the online hip-hop archive of all the lyrics of most major songs and did a study of who had borrowed lyrics from who and made a kind of an algorithmic model map. I guess it's a little blurry, but you can see one of the most collaborative people in hip-hop is Snoop Dogg, for example. He's at the center of the map. Then Funkmaster Flex is always on a lot of people's albums. Jadakiss, Puff Daddy, Ludacris. Each person is kind of a relationship to the other, and these are nodes in a network where they're all exchanging lyrics and doing guest appearances on one another's albums. And I like to think of that as a kind of a three-dimensional model of this kind of collaborative process that hip-hop and various folk musics usually do. If you think about the distinction between folk music versus music from the fine arts where it's composed and given credit, most of the 20th century's archive of music comes from folk music, whether it's Gershwin, whether it's Aaron Copland, whether it's Charlie Parker, and so on. What I'm trying to evoke here, again with the idea of the gift economy, is that folk music has now become digital, and the way electronic music operates is kind of a global folk culture. So this map here is a really fun way of visualizing what I'm trying to kind of talk about with the idea of sampling and shared economies, gift economies. I'm going to just wrap up with one or two quick clips here of current projects. I just did this record with Trojan Records where they gave me access to literally their whole archive. And I want to play a quick example of quotation. Here we go. right, so then we skip to this one. Charlie Parker quoting Billie Holiday, Billie Holiday being quoted by B.B. Seaton in Kingston in 1967. All of those, of course, relate to Gershwin's Porgy and Bess from 1935, the opera that was a very controversial opera about race in America. But the idea here is that the quotation, there's a very famous essay by Emerson where he says, of quotation and originality, back in the 19th century, where he's essentially kind of trying to point out that America is a culture of quotation, and perhaps that's one of our gifts to the world at this point, is the ability to have both multiple versions of different cultures operating at the same time. So with that said, and I know we should wrap up for questions, but I want to just say that the CDs that you guys all got, I'm hoping that everybody views it as, again, a kind of gift economy of exchange. And the idea here is not just about just pressing play, but getting into a little bit more of a playful mode of change and transformation. So I guess, thanks. Mm-hmm.
While people are hopefully lining up to ask some questions, I'll go ahead and start off with one question. Actually relates to a previous conversation Hank and I had about, and it relates to what Paul Miller was saying, about sampling having a social, there's a social aspect to sampling. And one of the things that Public Enemy did, you referenced, you know, sampling just a tambourine hit or a snare hit, but you also sampled voices, like mm-hmm. voices from the past of the Black Liberation Movement. And I was hoping, you know, while the audience members are collecting their thoughts, you'd talk a little bit more about, yeah, the way that you put together those records in a way that sort of reanimated, you know, past voices in a new context, which was the Reagan era.
Well, I think that, you know, it's funny because, you know, Paul said, you know, said some incredible things about how, you know, music and its reflection to the past and how we, you know, reverberate things that we saw or treasured from back then. And one of the best things about sampling is it forces us to go backwards in history. It allows us to go back and seek these records out. And as you're seeking records out, you find information at the same time. Like, for example, I never knew who Clive Stubblefield was until I started, you know, sampling James Brown. And then after sampling James Brown, you realize that, well, you know, James Brown also had a bass player, and his bass player was Bootsie Collins. Bootsie Collins was also in Parliament Funkadelic. You know, so you start to understand that there's a historical lineage that happens between everything, all right? So musically, you know, yes, there's a community. And we just took a lot of the, you know, because, you know, one of the things that motivated me was, In the early 80s, you know, there was a sentiment about, you know, Black power and the movement as it being irrelevant. You know, it was like, you know, even our own people was kind of like shying away from the notion of Black consciousness, Black togetherness. It was kind of like early 80s that was going down. And I've noticed this being on Hofstra University campus where there was only 1% Black in there anyway. And I've noticed how we were kind of like, you know, kind of like, not kind of like, you know, almost want to forget about our past. So one of the things that I wanted to do was to echo our past. I wanted to make sure that our past reverberated through the communities. I wanted to make sure that kids out there had an understanding of who Malcolm X was, who, you know, who Angela Davis is, Huey Newton. A lot of the you know, the revolutionary leaders that have helped us, you know, to get a lot of the civil rights and the things that we have today. But I want to do it in a way that wasn't corny, you know, because, you know, you can be very, very, you know, corny on how you you use those things so that kids really don't vibrate to it. And I think that hip hop music has kind of like crossed the boundaries of that. And just like Paul said, once you put a beat behind something, it's very powerful. So that was one of the main reasons for using a lot of the sampling, especially when it comes to the vocals and stuff goes.
So questions from the audience.
Can I just jump in real quick?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. We're talking about referential meaning in music, and that is what the meanings that music refers to, and it can be certainly something that literally provides a sense of the most profound ontological or cultural and life world meanings of any given people, and in some cases, in some litigations, plaintiffs have said that you've captured the essence of my music, the essence of what it's referring to. One instance of that was the Beastie Boys case, that is Newton v. Diamond in the Ninth District. It's where James Newton 5 times voted the greatest jazz flute player in the world, a great composer and flute player, sued the Beastie Boys, Michael Diamond et al., for the use of a sample. Now, they actually got a legal clearance on the sample because James Newton had sold the master recording rights. But they didn't get a license on the underlying music because they didn't think they needed to. The underlying music was simply 3 notes. Da-da-dum. That he was singing falsetto while playing his flute at the same time. So he's it's called vocalization, and playing the flute and overblowing the flute, and as a result, on one note, creating a cascade of sounds. He said that creation captured a certain sense of sub-Saharan African culture that and jazz, and in fact, that particular double technique has been in existence in sub-Saharan cultures for about 700 years, for about 500 years in Japan, and for at least 100 years in Eastern Europe. I was the music expert on the other side, that is, working for Beastie Boys, and indeed we prevailed. But the point is that it was very difficult for us, and I think for the judge, to be able to objectify something like referential meaning in music, and yet part of the problem in these copyright issues is that the only thing that we can objectify are things that we can empirically say are right or wrong. You know, you're correct, you're incorrect. It's like a music theory exam for an undergraduate. You say, well, you've got parallel fifths there, that's a mistake. And as I always tell our students, that's not why you became a musician. Is correct or incorrect in music is not its most powerful message. The problem is that it's difficult for us to provide objective facts and empirical data for a court to say things about the most important things about music, and that is what makes some of these litigations so vexing.
Hank was dying to say something. Yeah.
It is Larry, right? Yeah. Not Henry, right?
You can call me Henry.
I'm joking. I'm just joking. It's funny because there's one thing that amazes me is that, we're talking about sampling, and basically the only time we talk about sampling in a legal sense, we're only talking about sampling from the recording end of it, all right, the actual disc, not the information embodied in the disc, okay? So a lot of times that, these artists, the musicians that made these particular records, they don't benefit from that, all right? So we're talking about And the other thing is this is something that's kind of like baffling me, is that because it's everything that we get from a recorded medium comes from a disc, so that particular medium is what I consider to be standardized. It's the only way that we can get that particular recording, a particular information from that particular musician, is through that particular medium. So thus, when we take that particular medium and any form of it, just a hit, a scratch, anything, we are violating a copyright infringement, which doesn't really hit the musician.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of musicians don't own the sound recordings, or sometimes often the publishing, the underlying composition, the stuff that's embodied in the disc. And Paul, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I mean, I thought that Beastie Boys lawsuit was lunacy. I mean, if you actually hear the recording, it's just like a basic, your average ear, it sounds like a breath, you know? So it was like, the guy's like, you're sampling my breath. There's also a famous case where John Cage did the piece 4 minutes 33 seconds where it was silence, and a guy had a song, you know, on a record where it was just silence for 4 minutes, and they sued him. You know, so you can, I guess they were trying to sue the empty space of the digital bytes on the, representing the silence, maybe. But at the end of the day, most of the stuff, I mean, there's two strategies. One, as an artist or a creative figure, my recommendation is just be creative and keep editing beyond recognizability. And then the other issue is, of course, just maybe we need to update the formula on that, because it's ridiculous. I thought it was one of the dumbest lawsuits I've seen in a while.
I think it has the same thing as you know, then why can't we copyright a note? Why can't we copyright, you know, the microphone should have a copyright on the transmissions that go through it? Because basically what we're talking about sampling, that's what we're talking about.
The Gibson guitar.
Exactly. You know, and so
it's the distinctive sound of the Gibson guitar.
And so that's why those are the things to me where the sampling issues need to be kind of like directing that energy towards, because, you know, I just think that the medium itself is basically allowing them to make money or profit off just having that particular medium. And I think that that's so in violation of what the original spirit of copyright infringement is.
Yeah, but okay, there's also the term due diligence, where you spend X amount of time trying to figure out who owns what, and guess what? Most of the stuff from after a certain period is especially from the more obscure records, you know, it's, you just can't find the people. Mm-hmm. What's that?
You're absolutely right. But you know something? There's a uniqueness that happens when you're talking about a recording that actually comes from the 60s, for example. Yeah. You know, the compressors, the board that's being used, the microphone that's being used, everything the way. None of that stuff cannot be recreated with the authenticity of it. No, it cannot. You can try to emulate it as much as possible. And then the other thing that you also want to get out of it is you want to get the musician's feel and tone of which, you know, you can take any one of us can blow a saxophone in here. We each are going to blow it differently. We're going to have a different tonality to the way we hit that. And that's what you also want as well.
It's what phenomenologists call the sound in time. And there's a distinctive sound in time in funk, for example, in the 70s. And that's why it was so heavily sampled. Not because people in the late 80s and 90s were lazy. It's because they wanted a particular analog sound that they couldn't recreate, and a particular swing, in fact. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's something in between literally swing and playing an eighth note straight. It's sort of like Ringo Starr, you know. So it's not quite straight eighth notes, and it's not da-da-da-da-da-da. It's not Glenn Miller. It's somewhere in between that is just so specific to certain groups like Funkadelic, Parliament, Funkadelic, and so on. And that sound, and that's why they did it. They did it for real artistic reasons, not simply because they were lazy.
Wait, I'm sorry. Even though you asked the question, sadly, I've had Marjorie over here hanging. So please ask your question. Sorry.
Thank you, Kembru. I'm Marjorie Hines from the Brennan Center at NYU, and I wrote the report on Will Fair You Survive, which most of you probably have. I just wanted to clarify the Bridgeport case because it's been mentioned a couple of times today. It was not a case about fair use. It was a case about what's called the de minimis doctrine, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's the courts have said, if you take so little of something, especially if it's not even recognizable, it's not going to be an issue for the federal courts. Go away. It's trivial. And so, as Larry said, the lower court in the case rightly said, this is unrecognizable, it's one note, it's de minimis. And that's what the Court of Appeals in the Sixth Circuit overturned. And they said, we're going to make a special rule for sound recordings that doesn't apply to any other form of creativity that's covered by copyright law. And for sound recordings alone, there will be no de minimis. You take one note, it's unrecognizable, two notes, you have to pay for it.
You're okay with one? Okay.
It would even apply to one. Well, interestingly, there were a lot of people who were upset about this decision, including the recording industry. And they act. There were a couple of the lawyers for the defendants filed a motion for rehearing, telling the court it was totally wrong. A couple of friend of the court briefs were filed in support of rehearing, including one from the Recording Industry Association, saying, "You, without even mentioning fair use, which wasn't an issue in the case because we never even got there, it was dismissed on de minimis grounds, you, Sixth Circuit, have just eliminated fair use. And we're happy with fair use. We think it's important. So you screwed up and you should grant rehearing." Well, the judges were very determined to retain the decision that they decided to make, but they realized that they had screwed up by suggesting that fair use would be eliminated. So they did grant rehearing, and they modified the opinion and said, there is still no de minimis for sound recordings, but of course the fair use defense is still available. The problem with that is de minimis, you get rid of the case right away. Fair use, you can spend hundreds of thousands of dollars litigating it, and it's very unpredictable. But the fact of the matter is, and I don't know how the case finally came out, but the fact of the matter is, sampling satisfies a lot of the factors of fair use. It's transformative, it's taking a small amount, it's certainly not a substitute for the original recording. What's interesting here is how widely the Bridgeport decision is thought to have eliminated fair use, and how widely the industry practice, just as people were talking about with publishing and other and film before, the industry practice in music ignores what the law of fair use is and simply says, get permission for everything. So there's this disjunction between the law and the practice.
Well, the question would be, was how do you reach the producers, or just to say, or the artists, or the kids that are coming up? How do you reach them to even let them know that information? That, to me, seems...
I just tend to think that the law, the way the law is written and the way we actually live are just parting ways, you know? And you can write every law and try and write every bit and piece into the United States code, but your average kid is going to wake up in the morning and download some files.
Okay, so we only have time for one more question, and I see someone standing over there.
I've got too many questions, so I'll let somebody else ask one.
Oh, no, okay. Why don't you ask just one of them then?
Okay, sure. There was recounted a case, and another case, a thing related to it, alluded to by the lawyer, one in from the end, whom I can't see, I'm sorry. And you won a case, and the court said this thing is, what's the word, ludicrous? What's frivolous?
He's a rapper.
Frivolous. And so, all right. But evidently, in that particular venue, the judge finds the case frivolous of one side, and there's no penalty under law for bringing a frivolous case that's wasted the court's time. Uh-huh. This is the old question of who pays when you lose in a civil case.
Right.
Obviously, the loser pays. But I'm not suggesting that. But if it's found to be frivolous, it's certainly triple damages. That's minimum. You got to have that in the court system. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the big guys step on the little guys. Mm-hmm. And Lord knows there's more and more of that going on.
Excellent point.
Sorry.
Excellent. Now, see, that one question was worth it.
I think on the other hand, that would also tend to provide a chilling effect on the, if we're talking about the big people, then the small people worrying, perhaps being misadvised sometimes about the substance of their case, and then going forward and having the possibility that they would have to pay damages, it cuts both ways. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, I just got overruled by the other conference organizer to let one more question happen, and then we're going to have Lawrence Lessig come up and drop some knowledge on our asses.
My name is Kira Gunn. I'm a professor here in ethnomusicology, and I have a question that's... I'm writing about what I think is the sampling that goes on in oral and kinetic culture and African-American culture that leads into what hip-hop is, and it just occurs to me that there's this thing where we're limiting production, like the ability for people to be able to produce these things and have access to creativity and be able to freely create. And then we're controlling conception. And I just began to think, you know, if you look at what's going on with international copyright, with borrowing of things from Africa or from Indonesia and what's going on there, I wanted to ask if you might talk about how all of this, what we're talking about, seems to be pulling people apart, not just in the U.S., but globally, with what we can and cannot create together, and if there's anything for you around that question, as far as the things that you've been doing internationally with artists, or the things, you know, even the issue of covers and the ways that race politics played with that internally, but how that also plays out internationally.
Well, I work with many international artists.